Well, welcome back to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about several movies that are currently in the theater, starting with Downton Abbey.
Well, I want to give what I call a quasi-Marxist interpretation of this.
Okay.
Which will take all the fun out of it, right? But the most snide review I read, and you know, commercially it's done okay. The reviews have been mixed, and I'm mixed to negative on it, I'll say right up front. But the most snide review I read said that this is a movie about house cleaning. And it is in a way. Now, specifically at Downton Abbey, you know, backstory, of course, would be seven seasons on television. Now we get a feature film that begins in 1927, as the series would have left off, or between wars, if you will. The British aristocracy doesn't quite know the end is near, but there are rumblings that the end might be near for that old landed gentry lifestyle. The specific reason for all this intensive house cleaning is that the King and Queen of England are coming to pay a visit, and you have to get things spick and span. Now, as part of that visit, the royal couple travels with their own household. And so the resident servants, this is one of the quintessential upstairs-downstairs
exactly.
things, the residential servants there, this is the first revolution in history in which the servants rebel because they've been told to take the night off. they want to work that evening. They don't want the royal retainers doing that. And so that scene, but then also very late in the film, there's a scene where two of the servants are talking, and ironically, it's the servants who become the biggest defender of the aristocracy, of the landed gentry, of keeping that house that's been there for 300 years or whatever. And it's the aristocrats who are having some quibbles and doubts, you know, can we keep this going? Should we sell the house and all? But who defends the old order? The faithful servant. And to me, immediately, I started thinking about lost cause ideology in terms of plantation society in the antebellum South and everything in the aftermath of the Civil War by way of that kind of philosophy. Namely, that the servants love massa. They love working on the plantation. They would never want to be freed. They never want to go elsewhere. They just love their jobs so much. And it's the most conservative, borderline reactionary kind of philosophy because it takes that old order, that old hierarchy, and not only reinforces it, but says, you know, the people at the bottom, and this is sort of the Marxist take, the people at the bottom, the workers, the proletariat, if we can describe a proletariat in Downton Abbey, the proletariat, if you will, they love their jobs, they want to keep their jobs, and so on. And then you do have those scenes that are kind of cringeworthy, for me at least, of, you know, the benevolent master, if you will, the aristocrats who are so indebted to their servants in so many ways, and that love that goes back and forth. And I have to allow for that as, you know, in real life, that there would have been relationships like that. And indeed, the psychological dynamic could be there. But the film itself takes it as a given that it's the servants who really, more than anyone, want to keep that order going. I thought, I don't know. I mean, I might enjoy polishing silver, but do I want my children to polish silver, too?
Well, I mean, those are all very valid points. But I think it's meant to be more like Remains of the Day, where it's not so much about the polishing or the status of you know, working in a important house and actually getting to rub shoulders or even breathe the same rarefied air as the king and queen. It's about the relationships. And I'm a fan of the show, so I mean, I know all the backstories of all the characters. There is one character that you saw briefly, whose name is Daisy, who's sort of the young up-and-coming Briton who, you know, is starting to question these things. But, you know, she can because she's young enough, she's got time to think about other possibilities. So she's like the voice of dissension in a way.
There are several voices of dissension. Daisy, you're right. Daisy would be one. There's kind of flirtation with topicality, a kind of flirtation with real issues. And sometimes it's quite clever. For instance, this film takes place 1927, a year after the general strike. And, you know, naturally the aristocracy was rattled by that the lower classes would take to the streets like that. So Violet, I love saying the Dowager Countess, and mm-hmm. Maggie Smith is terrific.
Fantastic.
I mean, she's really just absolutely wonderful in it. But when the conversation, it's sort of like dinner table conversation. When the general strike comes up just a year or so afterwards, she complains that her maid had been, quote unquote, rather curt with her. And that's her take on the general strike. And there's actually some very clever scenes where that gets alluded to, but ultimately it's kind of frustrating. Because sometimes it seems like a sort of a toss-off. What I'm getting at, one of the subplots has to do with an assassination attempt. And it's not entirely convincing. I mean, in terms of the political situation, you can justify it that in terms of the Irish Republican cause and what's going on in Ireland and how people would want to strike out against the king and so on. Yeah, that's all, you know, historically grounded. But within the dramaturgy, if I can use that heavy-duty term for a light film like this, within the film, it seems kind of tossed off. It just seems like we need some incident. We need something to happen here. How quickly it's foiled and how quickly they go back to more or less normal. To me, that indicates overall that there's a kind of genteel melodrama here. Even when things get out of hand, they don't get too out of hand.
That scene, I think, though, was meant to make you question whether the chauffeur who married the youngest daughter who died was really, you know, one of them. Was he going to be loyal to his Irish heritage? Or, you know, was it just, you know, now that his wife and his link to this family is gone, you know, is his loyalty still there? I think that's all that whole scene was about.
Well, I think the real problem there is there's really not that much. When you come down to a push come to shove, there's not much of a story here. It's more the setting. Because I did enjoy the film, but at what level? I enjoyed the house cleaning, I suppose. In other words, you know, how can you go wrong when you have a drop-dead gorgeous house mm-hmm. and the property and well-spoken.
And the fabulous clothes.
And yeah, it's all about interior design and clothing and this and that. And it's easy for me to make fun of that, but I'm really not making fun of it because there's a lot of, you know, maybe on the surface, but there's a lot of pleasure on that surface, and it's really enjoyable to watch it. But the problem there is the big plot point really is the royal visit and everything spinning off of that, including the assassination plot spinning off of that. And then it's all those scenes of preparing for the visit. And yes, I was kind of mesmerized by it. I mean, it doesn't look like my house particularly. And so I enjoyed it. My servants are not as well behaved.
Were they curt with you?
They have been curt on occasion, yes. They threatened a general strike even. So, at the level of wish fulfillment, I mean, you know, and again, this is genuine pleasure. You watch a film, so wouldn't that be the life to live in that house, to have people waiting on you hand and foot? And I would love to live there and live like that. I would love to have servants who love me that much. I mean, it would really be sweet that way. Actually, ironically, I do have servant stairs in my old house, but no servants. So watching this film, there is that kind of pleasure. But I think when it tries to work in political points, or as you say, kind of like generational points, like the, you know, the new Britons coming mm-hmm. in and so on, I can see it there. I mean, I'm not oblivious to it. I can see it there in the script. But to me, it does seem sort of like a one-off or sort of like, you know, embroidered on. It doesn't, to me, seem as integral or as deeply developed as it might be.
See, I think the movie is sort of like going to a wedding where you're going to, you know, there's lots of people making small talk. So it doesn't really go into a lot of depth, but there's an enjoyment to be have of simply enjoying a happy occasion as opposed to all the terrible ones you have to participate in as a human being. To see some old friends and to see how people are doing. And I think that's what that movie feels like for a lot of people. And interestingly, the king and queen are the least interesting people in the movie.
They're really rather dull.
You don't care at all about them.
They're pretty dull, aren't they?
They really are. You're not anxiously waiting to see what they're going to do or when they're going to arrive or what they're wearing. Their scenery, which is kind of a hard trick.
When people wonder about the private lives of the royals, what if they really don't have much? What if it is all surface? What if it's kind of boring actually behind it? And I actually was sort of amused by that because the servants are all much more interesting than the royals.
Yes, actually downstairs is more interesting than upstairs. But they didn't get into a lot of the relationships that they went through with the TV show.
Well, presumably we're going to have more movies in this series. And in other words, and in fact, the producers of it have already acknowledged as much. The film's done reasonably well at the box office. It will have a long shelf life. And what's going to happen is that the way the story is set up, there's no reason why. Some of the characters may not make it. We have indications of who mm-hmm. might die or this or that. But in some ways, it's like a superhero movie, right? Some of the superheroes might not make the cut next time out because they couldn't come to contractual agreement. They may not make the cut, but the series itself will go on forever. The force will always be with us. So this story is set in 1927, so why not 1928? You know, we can count our way down towards World War II, and then that gives us a lot more to work with. So I think actually, you know, joking aside, I think that is going to happen. I think there's certainly a built-in very loyal audience for this. Built-in audience.
That is the truth, because when I went to get tickets, that thing was sold out in no time. That entire theater. Nobody walked out on that movie. Everybody stayed for that movie, all the way to the end, all the way through the credits. And everybody laughed at every single thing Maggie Smith said.
Well, it takes them longer to get up out of their seats and walk out. I was thinking how to say that in a graceful way, but I just had to blurt it out finally.
I'll let the audience deal with you on that.
I know. I better look over my shoulder on the way to the parking lot.
The best line that Maggie Smith had was when she tells Lady Mary that she's going to have to be the scary old lady.
Well, I've always loved, as an actor, I've always loved her, and I've seen her on stage before, and she's just an absolutely terrific actress. And there is some very clever writing here, and Julian Fellowes, who had written the TV show, also, you know, handled the script here. And to his credit, I mean, he has, you know, not maybe Oscar Wilde caliber, but pretty close enough in places. Some of the scenes are very, very clever. It's a kind of drawing room comedy that way. And she has the best lines and the best line readings.
Yes.
It's all about how you deliver the line. And when she's just about to say something, you start laughing already because you know how cutting it. So if you think I'm being kind of snide or cutting, listen to her.
Take a look at Maggie Smith in Downton Abbey.
Yeah,
she was clearly the hero or the heroine in the movie because everybody followed her lines and always got a laugh. Even, I mean, she got the best lines too, but she's clearly the hero. And then after the movie, we took my group of people went to my house and had tea.
Oh.
And little sandwiches.
Isn't that a cucumber?
Actually, there were some cucumbers on some of those sandwiches.
Okay.
Yes.
And who
fussy little sandwiches.
Who had the best lines?
I don't know. Probably one of my sisters.
Okay. Was there a presidential visit during
this? There was not, thank God.
Was the house clean?
No, not up to those standards. Things were not gleaming.
So you have a lot of silver?
Yeah, well, no. Oh, well, I didn't get the silver out. I did get the china out. But there were a few dust bunnies that might have joined us at the
table. You got the house stainless steel out?
I got the good stainless out.
Not too many smudges on it.
You'll have to come over and judge.
So why don't we move along, and what's next on our list?
Ad Astra, To the Stars. And this is also a movie that got a lot of buzz, and there were a lot of expectations for this movie. And my first reaction to the movie was that we have a scheduling program here on campus called Ad Astra. And I thought, wow, I hope this is going to be a two-hour movie about scheduling software. I thought, you know what? It's got Brad Pitt in it. I can look at him for 2 hours.
You need to get off campus more often, I think.
I have to say, I was not a fan of this movie. In spite of Brad Pitt, I thought this was a complete snooze fest.
Yeah, I share your feelings about it. There's a basic problem here, and there's nothing wrong, essentially, with the thematics of it. You know, kind of like basic father and son story, if you will. But then when you watch how it plays out, it's very heavy-handed. And with a lot of the masculinity issues and so on their own terms, it gets kind of heavy duty there and a bit of a snooze fest, if you will. But then secondly, on a very pragmatic level, when you think about like what I call the space program, I still call it the space program. Mm-hmm. When you think of all of the money and all the effort and everything going in, you know, to sort of effectuate a father-son reunion, it just is like hokey after a while.
Yes.
It just doesn't make sense to me at a certain point that it has to go this way. But for storytelling purposes, yeah, I guess it does. And then where it really lost me was towards the end of the film, the final sections of it, where it goes into some sort of quasi-abstract metaphysical realm that you know, unless you're Kubrick, you're going to have trouble pulling that off. And I don't think the film pulls it off at all. So it actually, even though it's like just the other side of 2 hours, it felt longer. What kept me with it was very watchable actors, number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, James Gray as a director knows his stuff. The film has some really good production design, and you know, even though it's kind of deliberate pace, he has a sense of how to handle a story. And he's a serious filmmaker. Think of films like The Immigrant or the underrated Lost City of Z. You know, at a time when most movies are just like bubblegum movies or faux profound movies, you know, like Joker, this one actually is delving into potentially what could be some really serious issues. And so I don't think it works at all. But to his credit, that he's making the attempt, he's making the effort there, that he's willing to make a serious film at serious length.
I have a quote here from director James Gray, who said that this movie will feature the most realistic depiction of space travel that's been put in a movie. And I completely disagree, because I'm pretty sure it takes longer than that to get to Neptune.
Well, that was my experience. No, the joking aside, there are quibbles like that where it seems like he zips along pretty quickly.
Right, like next day you're
And I think he should be like put in some hibernation for months at a time, whatever, and Brad Pitt should be like a gray beard when he gets,
yes.
You know, I mean, there should be issues like that that are dealt with. And instead, it's like taking the local, you know, train,
yes,
or something.
Yes, the express, because it doesn't stop at, you know,
yeah,
Jupiter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so that's where it was just like what I call this dangling questions that don't exactly derail the film, but like during the long stretches where they're just like, you know, staring into space, my mind is thinking about those things, and it just doesn't seem. And I mean, I'm not an expert on space travel, but just layman's sense that it wouldn't work that way or quite that fast. Moreover, you know, without spoiling too much, but as he heads off to, you know, try to find Tommy Lee Jones, it does, frankly, get kind of hokey that way in terms of, well, what happened to your dad? And you know, when you're hanging out for a few decades by yourself, what do you do to pass the time? you have to allow it a lot of creative leeway there in terms of how the program itself would work, and moreover, at the interpersonal level, what it would be like, you know, and it's unintentionally funny, almost like, you know, when it's like, Dad, is that you? It's something like, well, long time no see. What have you been doing out here for, you know, 20 some years?
Well, also the explosion that's supposed to, you know, slingshot him back to Earth.
Yeah.
All the way from Neptune.
Yeah. You had a problem with that?
I did. And I am no scientist, but that seemed like ridiculous to me. Also thought he held every long shot way too long, two or three beats too long.
Well, I agree and disagree on that, because generally I agree, but I disagree in the sense that sometimes, and Kubrick could do this, like you have a literally spacey kind of stretch or moment where sometimes like hold the shot. And that's like if you're in what I call the zone, if you're in that groove where you kind of, you'll float with it, right? And some of the scenes I did. And preferably ones that didn't have either too much story or dialogue, where it just, because he actually is a filmmaker, he's really a very good filmmaker. And there were some shots that were worth holding.
But if you're going over by 2 minutes, you got to cut down those long shots.
Well, it's 122 minutes, so that's not excessive. I mean, most superhero movies are longer than that.
But if you're trying to keep it at 2 hours, if you're going over at all, there's got to be a good reason.
Well, I agree to the extent that if he'd cut 5 or 10 minutes, yeah. But I didn't. Overall, I wasn't too bothered by that. It was the story itself that was bothering me.
I also could have done without the long, cynical voiceover in the long monotone, like it was Sin City.
We'll see how effective that is.
Yeah, I was bored. Actually, this could not have been more boring if it had been
But see, if you're looking for a bathroom break or a popcorn break between words, you could go out to the lobby and get your popcorn and come back and get the next word.
Didn't you find that really?
Yeah, it actually was. You know, again, when I say the movie's heavy-handed, that ponderous quality is very much in the scripting, certainly in voiceover, and it's a shame in so many ways, because Brad Pitt gives a really good performance.
Yeah, nothing
Isn't
wrong
he good?
With his performance. He's terrific.
He's really good. And
so is Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, Tommy Lee Jones is fine. Donald Sutherland. I mean, you have pro actors. They're
wasted
doing what they
in this movie.
Yeah, largely wasted, but they're acting at an A level, right? But the film itself, you know, I think visually it's at that level oftentimes. It's a well-made film.
The CGI is amazing.
Isn't it? It's a well-made film. That's what I'm saying. I'm not usually one to sing the praises of CGI, but when it's well done and to the purpose of the story, not just showing off, it was plausible at that level. How long it takes them to get to Neptune's another issue, but the actual vessels that they travel in, that's quite plausible. But it's kind of scattershot with some of the secondary characters. And the most egregious would be the Brad Pitt character, Major Roy McBride. He has that ex-wife. And did they have to give her the name Eve?
Yes.
I mean, boy, she's the woman. Her name is Eve, and I get it. And then Liv Tyler had nothing to work with there. It was a thankless role. But that's an example of where you have this overall concept, which essentially is father and son. And there isn't too much room for the women folk, if you will. And I think that's where they tried to work it in and make her seem symbolically important. But it's so fleeting there that when they're holding these shots of outer space for that extra minute, and I understand your point, maybe if they had a shot of her for another minute and she got to say something more, you know, like, well, why'd you divorce him, kind of, you know, something, something. Well, He's always flying off to Neptune. I want him home for dinner.
Is there anything to say that would recommend this movie?
Well, people who like sci-fi, and here I mean traditional sci-fi more, because although it does have some good special effects, it's not special effects driven. That's an important distinction. It's character driven. And even though it's faulty on that level, it's serious on that level. Goodness knows it's serious. but people who really like old school sci-fi, I think, might have a greater appreciation for it. Folks who are more tuned to today's superhero and sci-fi movies would be definitely bored by it, really impatient with it, because you don't have that many wow special effects. You have the character dynamics, which for all their flaws are still character dynamics. It's, you know, father and son and so on. And so I think people who really, you know, are attuned to the genre, its traditions, if you will, might want to see it. Secondly, people who are technically oriented, just in terms of good filmmaking. There isn't enough good filmmaking on display. Thirdly, those people who are completists in terms of particular actors. I mean, if you really like Brad Pitt, yeah, you're going to want to see it.
All good points. I do think that there's a opportunity in there for some cinematography nods at the Oscars.
It's going to get a lot of technical nominations.
Yes, a lot of technical nominations.
It may not get for acting or directing or picture.
Or writing. Even.
But, you know, in those craft categories, it's definitely going to get nominations.
It's a well-crafted film.
Yes, and sometimes I say that as like a backhanded compliment, but I don't mean it that way here. It's genuinely a well-crafted film.
But in terms of watchability, see The Martian instead.
Yeah, I'd agree with you.
So that brings us to Abominable.
Speaking of which.
And, you know, the first question I have is 3 Yeti movies?
And?
Well, I mean, actually, I think this one was the best one of Missing Link and
Are you planning a course on Yeti movies?
No, I just realized when I was watching, it was like, that's just interesting that 3 Yeti movies is kind of a lot.
It is a lot. Actually, it was too many for me. But but if I could, this is a complaint that I probably shouldn't make, so I'll make it anyway, which is there's a lot to say about Abominable in terms of the film industry today and the state of animation and so on, but also in terms of the state of Yeti movies. Should I put an S on that? Yeti, that's the plural as well, right? It doesn't get an S or anything? Yeti or Yeti X?
You would think after 3 movies I would know. I'd be an
expert. Well, here's my complaint that I probably shouldn't voice. This movie's clearly pitched at they like to say all ages. Children of all ages will love it, 9
yes.
to 90, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, it's basically pitched to kids. I mean, so much of it is. And the Yeti itself, which gets the name or nickname Everest, okay, which is kind of cute, but how should a Yeti look? And I had a lot of time to think about this because, you know, I wasn't with any small children and I was just watching it as an adult, and I see a lot of similar movies, but I'm watching the Yeti and it has this goofy grin on its face, which for me was like a bit too much at times. Like it's almost like that, like if you see a toy or a stuffed doll.
It's stuffed animal ready.
Yeah, it's stuffed animal ready. I could see it on the shelf. You know, I can see the ancillary tie-ins. Like
the Halloween costume.
Buy this doll or wear this costume. We might see actually this Halloween people dressed up as Yetis. But that goofy grin, to me, it was just like too much. You know, it's almost like if you had to hang out at a party with the Joker, right? You know, it gets to you after a while. Too much laughter, or too much Yeti grin. And that's where it just seems too much like that kind of stuffed toy now I don't know exactly how a Yeti should look, but I somehow wanted a more realistic Yeti, which I know is an unrealistic expectation. And then moreover, and this is where joking aside, where it's a more serious consideration is, what exactly are the attributes, the powers, if you will, of a Yeti? This was so flexible, so multivalent that ultimately just throw up your hands and say, well, it's magic.
It's magic.
But the things this Yeti could do. Now, if I were a 5-year-old kid, I wouldn't complain at all. But, you know, in fact, the scene I enjoyed because it was just so surreal was that this Yeti is able to, grow giant blueberries, which had not occurred to me as I was watching it. That would be one of its attributes. But I was trying to draw up like a checklist of what a Yeti has or could do. And it's just like, well, the sky's the limit. Everest is the limit. You know, you can do almost anything you want. But where it does, you know, joking aside, cause some problems in the film is, however ridiculous your premise, you need a certain amount of logical follow-through. In other words, once like the bad guys, I'll call them bad guys, are after the Yeti, like, okay, well, we know they're more or less human in what they can do in terms of driving, shooting, whatever, but what can the Yeti do? It really seems to vary from scene to scene, doesn't it? Sometimes it seems vulnerable, you can capture it, this and that. Other times it seems like it's got these, you know, these godlike powers, you know, zapping people around and you know, explosions and this and that. And I finally just thought, you know, it's so arbitrary there that you just have to go with that ridiculous flow, because otherwise you'd just be tossing your hands up constantly.
I didn't have a problem with the magic part. I thought those parts were fun to watch. The the wave-like grain and
yeah, they're
stuff
fun
like
to
that.
Watch. They're fun to watch. Shouldn't there be? I don't want to say limits so much as a sense of within the storyline, because they're trying to capture this thing.
Right.
And, but want a sense of what it can do and what it can't do?
But this is the visual potato chips part.
I guess so, but I mean, like at the beginning, like even if you're gonna have this thing in a cage, well, couldn't it just like break free? I mean,
the other things that I noticed about it that I thought were kind of good choices was that the cousin character looks like the Boy Scout in Up.
Yeah.
So you felt like that kid came back,
right?
And I have to say, in Missing Link, they did a better job with the clothing that they put on the characters, because you could see each detail that they'd done, because they had actually created physical.
This was more generic.
Much more generic.
Yeah.
But I think it was an outgrowth of the short film that won Best Animated Short, Bao.
Right.
Because they have, they sort of take that little story and expand
it. Which I
liked.
I like a nice
that
film.
Too.
It's a sweet film. I like that. But there's a difference between a short film and a feature-length film. That big grinning, goofy grinned Yeti in a 5-minute short would be delightful. At feature length, to me at least, it started to wear a little thin that way. But the thing I think is most important about the film actually is the film production itself. The fact that, we are finally belatedly getting more Asian characters, if you will, not so much in live action, but at least here, well, to some extent, Crazy Rich Asians and so on, but to some extent here in animation. And there's a very pragmatic reason for that. It's not all a matter of wanting to be humanitarians and fair and balanced with ethnic representation. It's simply that China is now the number two film market in the world, just behind the U.S. They're going to surpass us at some point. And if you look at the credits for Abominable, a lot of the actual animation work was done in Shanghai. And so the production credits were split between quote-unquote American talent and specifically Chinese talent. So the story is not only set there, and the characters are not only, definitely Asian characters, Chinese characters, and, within Chinese culture, but the fact that behind the camera, if you were back at the lab, it's really an Asian, I'm reading the credits there. There's some Anglo names, but a lot of Asian names. And so at that level of film production, you're seeing a lot of Hollywood films that now, to some extent, have not only financing, but actual production facilities they make use of in China. And then in terms of the release of the film and the marketing, very much thinking about the Chinese market. So, it's not just a matter of let's be nice and have more Asians on screen, whether animated or live action, but also behind the camera. And again, any jesting aside there, it's an important consideration is that it is a world film industry, and international, and it's being represented now in a kiddie film like Abominable.
I thought that they set it there in China and Beijing because they had to be on the right continent to get to Everest.
Well, there's so much magic in the film. I think if you can get to Neptune in a few hours, you can get across the ocean. No, but I mean, pragmatically, you're right that you should have, like Hong Kong, Beijing, it's not that far, more or less, to get to the Himalayas. So, yeah, there's obviously that aspect. But why is the film being made to begin with? And then where is it made? How's it made? That's where it feeds into the business considerations. It's the global marketplace, but more specifically the Chinese marketplace.
Yeah, I think you're onto something with that. I think also we are going to see some Halloween costumes like this, because any Halloween costume that involves fleece and fur is a winner, because you don't have to wear a coat over your costume.
I will keep that in mind as we approach the holiday.
I know you have so many choices, but you have to think of it like that.
Will anyone be dressed as Rambo?
That's a good question, because, he does have sort of a cool cachet to him. But really what makes that movie work is that people still want to see Stallone blow things up.
Exactly. The title is Rambo Last Blood.
It should be Lots of Blood.
No, or Last Drop. that first one came out, in 1982. First Blood came out in 1982, where he's the Viet Vet, and then all the sequels since then. He learned long ago that his reputation would be a 1-2 punch of Rocky and Rambo. Mm-hmm. When he tried other things, they never quite worked. I mean, I interviewed Stallone when he was doing Escape to Victory. He was trying to do a role other than that. And those other roles, generally speaking, just didn't click for him. So he's always gone back to this material. You know, I've got to give him credit for a guy who's getting up there. He looks great, mm-hmm. but he's still just doing the same old things. When he's tried to initiate other projects, again, either the films don't do all that well or they don't even get made. Like, for many years, he wanted to do a biographical film about the life of Edgar Allan Poe. He wanted to play Poe. And in fact, there was a very funny New Yorker magazine cartoon which has Stallone looking off, to the side there saying, "Yo, Raven." And thank God that one never got made. But any actor, and he's a limited actor, but he knows his range, as narrow as it might be. But it can be frustrating when you try to break out of that and do other things. But, the film is entertaining. It gets the job done. Let's put it that way.
It does get the job done. And speaking of the job done, we are going to wrap up now for this week's episode of At the Movies. But we will see you next time.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.